This evening I want to talk. Oh yeah, I don't know why it's not working today. Is it the normal switch not working for some? Yeah, some reason the normal switch. That's better. So the subject for my talk tonight is the subject of tranquility or calmness. And sitting here this evening with you all, I was quite aware of the rain. And for me, there's something very content-making about sitting inside of a dry room, warm room, when it's raining. And in a sense, there's all this noise and activity and outside. And inside, under the roof, there's a kind of feeling of calmness or peacefulness or stillness compared to the noise outside. So the idea of contentment, of calmness or tranquility. And I wanted to tell you a story that's told in the Buddhist tradition. It's probably somewhat of a legend, but it has some basis in fact. There was a king in ancient India named King Ashoka. And he was one of the first, or was the first kind of major Buddhist king of India. And he's held up as kind of a model of being a virtuous ruler. However, when he first became king, he wasn't so virtuous. And he spent a lot of time rolling around India with his army, conquering much of India. He was one of the first people to unify India. Apparently he was quite brutal, and there was a lot of carnage, a lot of murder, a lot of battles, and he was a ruthless conqueror. Until one day, there was a particularly ugly battle, a lot of death that he won, but it was a lot of death, a lot of people dying on the battlefield, a lot of people wounded, and he walked through the battlefield. And he was horrified at what he saw there in the battlefield. And I can imagine that beyond just simply all the dead soldiers and the wounded people crying, there was also the victorious soldiers who were helping themselves to the spoils of war, running around with their greed, taking whatever they could get. And he was horrified by the scene that was unfolding around him. And in the midst of this scene, midst of this battlefield, they walked across a Buddhist monk. And there was something about the serenity and tranquility and peacefulness about this Buddhist monk that stood in stark contrast with the battlefield that the king stood in. That the monk caught the king's attention. And he was wondering, you know, where does this kind of peace and calmness, tranquility, come from? And so he went over to talk to the monk, and he asked the monk, you know, how it could be that he could be the way he was, and if he had any teachings. And the monk recited a verse, and I don't know if it's a traditional verse attributed to the Buddha or what, but it's a verse that it's been said changed the course of Indian history. And the verse goes something like this: attentiveness is the path to the deathless. Inattentiveness is the path of death. Those who are attentive never die. Those who are inattentive are already dead. And so this really stopped the king, and it turned him around. There was kind of conversion experience, and it turned him around, and he renounced any more conquering, any more brutality, and kind of went 180 degrees the other direction, and set up did whatever he could do to kind of make it for a peaceful country, with building hospitals for people and for animals and for abolished capital punishment, did welfare for the poor, and many things for his people. But this idea, kind of thinking about calmness and tranquility, thinking about the effect or the power that a tranquil person can have on another person can be quite powerful, and as a result of that, maybe on history. Thich Nhat Hanh says that when the Vietnamese boat people were fleeing Vietnam. These very kind of rickety boats that were overcrowded. It was quite dangerous to be there in the China Sea when storms came up. And he claimed that if one person was calm in a crowded boat, it would help everybody else somehow find their way to safety. If one person could be calm. I was very impressed when I was a child by people around me who I thought were particularly calm and peaceful. And I found that particularly in people who are older, the elders of the community, the aged, both in Norway where I grew up there, and also I grew up in Italy, and there were these wonderful parks where people kind of, all these old, especially old men, lived in these parks during the day. And either they just sat there with their canes between their legs, kind of peacefully looking at the world around them, or they were very contentedly, seemingly to me, kind of chatting and talking with each other in this kind of loving way, and just, I don't know what they talked about, but there was something very content and peaceful and calm about these elders, these aged people. And I kind of was delighted with the idea, oh, maybe when I become old, I can be like them. That would be a great aspiration to have, to be at the same kind of peacefulness. It didn't occur to me that calmness or tranquility was something that I could pursue or develop or cultivate prior to getting old. But that's what we learned in doing a spiritual practice, that it is. Part of the motivation for me to talk about a little bit about calmness, or just bring up the topic, is that it belongs to a very important list, practice list, that we have in Buddhism. And this is the list of called the Seven Factors of Awakening. There are two lists which are very important for mindfulness students, people who do the kind of practice we do here. And the one list I think most of you are very familiar with, you're supposed to be intimately familiar with, is the five hindrances. And there's a lot of talk about the five hindrances, those things which hinder our ability to be really fully present. But equally important, but not given as much discussion, is what's called the seven factors of awakening. Not the things that hinder our awakening or our presence, but rather the factors of mind that come into play to help and encourage our ability to be fully present in an open, compassionate, loving way, a free way. And in this list of seven, one of the factors is tranquility and calmness. Tranquility or calmness. The word is pasadi in Pali. And in the seven factors of awakening, they're divided into kind of two groups. The first group is a group of one, which is just mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness which we do. The other group is the two divisions which balance each other out, help create balance in our life. And this is kind of what I was thinking about today, is how it's possible to search for, to cultivate balance in our life when we find ourselves imbalanced. So these factors are the quieting or the tranquilizing or the settling factors, three of them, and the other three are those which are activating or arousing factors. And the arousing factors are such things like investigation, interest, to really be interested in something. Energy or vitality, bringing engagement with our life, with our practice. And the third energizing factor is joy, rapture, to feel some joy or some happiness. To cultivate joy and happiness is the way of getting energy, of uplifting us. And at times when we're feeling really blah or really tired or really depressed, sometimes it's possible to find simple ways, not always so simple to do this, but to find ways to arouse these factors, to become more joyful or to become more, whatever kind of way you can, or to get more energy. The other day I felt, we keep our house really warm now. And I don't know if the baby appreciates it or even needs it, but the parents seem to think the parents need to think that they're taking care of the baby. So we have the heat up, And it's kind of lethargy producing. So I noticed, I could feel this, you know, that my energy was kind of sinking. And so I thought, oh, what I need is more energy. And so what I did was went out and went for a run. And that was, did a great, you know, fresh air and a run did me great. The settling or the quieting factors are concentration. Concentration practice is a calming, tends to be calming. Tranquility itself. And then the third one is equanimity. So we have these two things. We have the arousing factors and the quieting or settling factors. And mindfulness is kind of the king or the ruler or the balancer, which sits kind of on top of all of it. And actually, if you only dedicate yourself to mindfulness, it said, you can naturally come to balance between these two things. But sometimes our life gets so imbalanced, it's useful to think of something or do something that actually can strengthen one of those qualities. So one of the things we do, one of the things that's encouraged for mindfulness students to do is to become really familiar with these seven factors of awakening, to know what they are, and to be able to recognize them in oneself when they're present, to recognize what investigation or interest is like, and to really honor it when it's there. When vitality and engagement is there, when concentration or joy or equanimity or tranquility are there, to honor them and appreciate them. And part of the reason for this is, as it said in one of the suttas, the food for the seven factors of awakening is knowing that they're there. If you recognize one of the factors when it's there, that feeds it in a helpful way. Inattentiveness to its presence starves it. It's kind of like things live on our attention. And if we don't bring our attention to it, we starve it. So if there is some modicum of calm or tranquility in our life, but we don't honor it, we don't honor it with our attention, we don't recognize it, then it's very hard for that to become a stronger and stronger part of our life itself. There was a story that it's told many times, I hope it's true, but it's kind of in the lore of the Vipassana world now, is that a story of a woman who came to a teacher during a Vipassana retreat and said, I feel really unusual. I don't know what it is. And the teacher said, well, you should really go investigate it and come back and tell me what you think it is. She came back and said, oh, you know, I'm calm. I've never been calm in my life, so I didn't know what it was. But so, you know, to learn to recognize it can be a big deal. So the seven factors grow with our familiarity, with our recognizing of them. Also, once we're familiar with them, it's possible sometimes to evoke them, to call on them. To call on energy. Say, well, I need more energy. And you can kind of sometimes feel that energy will appear. Just kind of call on it and sit up a little bit straighter. Investigation. Sometimes you can call on interest in investigation. What's going on here? What's the resistance here? What's really happening for me right now? And calmness itself can be called upon. Partly because calmness is something which is actually always present. Tranquility is always around. Much more than most of us recognize or realize. The opposite of calmness, I suppose, would be agitated mind, agitated body, restless body, being preoccupied, disturbed, full of anxiety, running around with 10,000 ideas and things, chores and ideas and plannings that are going on in the mind. And the mind can be kind of like very turbulent at times. Maybe something like a turbulent surface of the ocean. And what happens to our attention is to our kind of life force or our life vitality or whatever, our intention, is we tend to relate very closely with what we're preoccupied with. It's kind of like we're riding really tight with our preoccupations. So if we're really anxious about something, we're going to give a presentation at work tomorrow, and we tend to kind of glue ourselves to that worry about that presentation. And when we glue ourselves to a preoccupation, or if the mind is turbulent, there's many preoccupations that are spinning around, We tend to ride very closely all these different things, and we don't see that in the moment there's actually a lot more going on than our narrow little preoccupation with one little thing. We are much more than what we're thinking in any particular moment. Have you heard the story, the teaching from Munindraji, where he said, the way he said it was, the thought of your mother is not your mother. The thought of yourself, the thought of your work tomorrow is not your work tomorrow. The thoughts we have are actually a very small subsection or a fantasy or ideas, and have nothing to do with the full-fleshed reality of what's going to happen tomorrow or the person you're thinking about, or about yourself and what you're worried about within yourself. So to realize there's more to us than our thoughts, and to realize that it's possible not to ride glued on top of our thoughts and our preoccupations, and there's much more going on here. And that more, that wider sphere that's wider than our thoughts, tends to be a much more calmer place. The image, again, is that of the ocean. If you're riding the surface of the ocean, like you're riding the surface of your mind, it can be quite turbulent, like it probably is right now out there. But if you go 10 feet under the water in the ocean, and some of you might have been scuba diving or skin diving, you can feel tremendous peace or quiet that seems unconnected to the turbulence above. You can look up and maybe see it, but 10 feet or 20 feet below, it feels very peaceful and spacious and vast. It's somewhat like that, I think, for us. And one of the functions of meditation practice is to help us to connect to that which is larger than our preoccupations with our thoughts. And as we do that, we tend to find a calmer world that we live in. The calmness is always here. I bring up the issue of calmness because I think many of us living our busy lives that we live, our lay lives, going to work and family and obligations and everything we do, many of us find ourselves being agitated, being not being calm, being the opposite of it. And part of what we do in mindfulness practice to some degree is to see how we can bring a life back into balance. And by actively thinking about and looking about and recognizing calmness, recognizing the absence of calmness, recognizing perhaps it's a good idea to be calm or tranquil, what can I do to become calm and tranquil? Can I slow down a little bit? Can I stop my activities? Can I stop and meditate? Can I take a break? Can I slow the pace in which I'm working? What can you do to become calmer is a very, very important quest when we're quite agitated. To get more busy, so we tend to so focus so much on objects outside of ourselves, to more sights, more sounds, more money, more people, more activities, more something to do it for us. I guess I don't have to tell you this crowd necessarily, but the idea of stepping back and doing less is quite foreign to some people. And part of the function of doing meditation practice is it becomes an excuse for many of us to stop doing so much, an encouragement for many of us to stop doing so much. We really stop and allow the inner tranquility and calmness to become a part of our life. A spiritual life unfolds the best, A spiritual life tends to unfold better if we're calm and relaxed, if we're calm and tranquil. There are some people who feel that, well, calmness and tranquility is kind of a... You're not going to get ahead in life if you're calm and tranquil. If you're calm and tranquil, you're kind of a pushover. You're kind of a dud. You're kind of boring. And so I think for some people, calmness and tranquility has a kind of bum rap. And so there's reluctance to kind of cultivate and find it. But my reply to that is that it's important to remember that calmness exists as one of the seven factors of awakening. And that what we're looking for in Buddhism is not calmness, because calmness, anybody who meditates for a long time will realize that states like calmness come and go. And you can have some control over it, perhaps, but they come and go regardless of what you want. And so that itself cannot be the goal of a spiritual life. But the movement towards not clinging, to not being attached to things so tightly, not riding glued onto our preoccupations, is one that finds the seven factors of awakening becoming stronger and stronger elements. And the idea is not to have calmness there by itself, but the idea is to have calmness, quite strong element in our life, but together with the strength of interest, of vitality, of a stability of mind, of equanimity, and mindfulness itself, is part of kind of what we're looking for, what happens naturally as we become more mindful, as we become more less attached and less clinging. I think that calmness or tranquility, this word pasadi, is different than relaxation. It's a little bit different than de-stressing ourselves, because many of us are stressed out and we try to relax ourselves. It's possible to become tranquil while the body is still tense. I don't know what it is. Tranquility is kind of this warm contentment or warm peacefulness or warm stillness that somehow can kind of begin radiating through the body and kind of move into the places of tension in the shoulders or whatever, and maybe not release it, but somehow infuse it with some other quality, this quality of tranquility or calmness. So in saying this, I think it's useful to think about there's two kinds of calmness or tranquility. There's tranquility of the body, and there's tranquility of the mind. And sometimes tranquility of the body is attained first by cultivating tranquility of the body. The mind is in a flurry of activity and preoccupied with all kinds of concerns and has a certain amount of momentum that it's going with. But if we can hold the body still and do what we can to develop calmness in the body, just by breathing, being with the breath, inhalations, exhalations, breathing in, breathing out, kind of like the scuba diver who goes 10 feet, 20 feet under the surface of the ocean, and the scuba diver, you know, really is attentive to his or her breathing. And I know scuba divers feel very calm and centered because they're so attentive to the breathing deep down underneath. I don't know if that's a good analogy, but just staying with the breath, being in the body, as a way, if nothing else, as a way of not buying in to our tendency to be preoccupied with our thoughts. If we don't buy into our thoughts will quiet themselves. It said the best way to quiet, to calm the mind, is to not give it much attention. And one of the ways not to give it so much attention, so much preoccupation, is to connect our attention to the breathing in the body. And it tends to be calm-producing, tranquilizing. Not always. And it depends a lot what's going on in our life and any particular day or month or year or season of our life, how successful we can be to become calm, make ourselves calmer or more tranquil. But it's possible. And one of the ways to do it is through the body. The body becomes more tranquil. Sometimes the word stillness is used in Buddhist meditation practice. Stillness, not so much a stillness of the world, but a stillness of the heart. Not so much a stillness of the mind, but a stillness of that capacity of presence which doesn't react to things. We can allow things to arise, but we don't react to it. But that actually comes into the next subject, which I won't talk about, which is equanimity. The difference between equanimity. So what's very fascinating about Buddhist psychology or Buddhist meditation is the ability in which we can start discriminating very well between different states of mind that many of us perhaps don't distinguish between in normal life. And one of them, I think, that's useful because it's one of the seven factors, two of the seven factors, is the distinction between tranquility and equanimity, calmness and equanimity. Calmness has a kind of pleasure to it. There's kind of pleasure in the body, pleasure in the mind, that gets born when we start becoming tranquil or calm. And it's really a marvelous, wonderful, vitalizing, and very pleasant sensation. Tranquility is not, calmness is not nothingness, it's not dullness, it's not lethargy. It has a kind of vibrancy to it, aliveness, which is quite pleasant and quite warm. Equanimity has no sensual quality to it. Calmness has a kind of sensual quality. Equanimity has no essential quality. And equanimity is that capacity to allow things to arise, whatever it is, and the mind or the stillness within us doesn't get swayed by it. We don't react habitually. There might be liking and not liking of it, but we're not caught by the liking and not liking. So what if I like it? So what if I don't like it? I'm not going to push it away because I don't like it. I'm not going to judge it and attack it. And equanimity is this wonderful ability that allows things to be there, and there's no reaction to it at all. And I call it sometimes a Teflon mind. But I don't know if that does it justice, because it kind of demeans it, perhaps, by giving it such a kind of name. But it's equanimity also is a really beautiful state of mind. So to repeat, I know it's very difficult to cultivate calmness. It's not an easy thing. But I think it's useful to think about it and reflect on it and learn to recognize it when it's there. Learn to recognize it, perhaps, that it's there more often than you realize. Before coming over here, I was at Whole Foods shopping. And I was a little bit concerned that I was going to come late. So there was this little bit feeling of kind of a little bit of hurry and kind of in the background. And the woman in front of me in the line, she seemed to be taking a long time. And my mind, for a few little moments there, was beginning to lose its calmness. And luckily I noticed that. And so that's very significant to notice that I was losing it. And then I said, oh, this is interesting. And as soon as I noticed that, this is interesting, that itself kind of infuses a kind of calmness into my non-calmness, because I'm not so caught by it anymore. And then I kind of reminded myself, or it wasn't so much a reminding, it was more like a rose by itself, this kind of feeling or this idea. Nothing ever happens. Nothing ever needs to happen. There's a tremendous amount of calm and stillness, even in Whole Foods. Not just within me, but just in the room around me. There's all this activity, but there's all this vastness, this spaciousness, this stillness happening within it. And what was fascinating to me, what brought kind of joy and kind of investigation and kind of an edge to me, was there was this kind of the edge of this feeling of there's all this calmness here and calmness within me that's there for sure. I could feel it and sense the stillness and that nothing is happening at all. Because nothing ever happens anyway. And my movement to make things happen and get things going and get here in time. And it was kind of like this: these two things were meeting. And it wasn't like I could just let go of my hurry, just like that. But my hurry and my preoccupation, my busyness of my mind, was meeting the stillness of my mind. And the two met, in the meeting of them, between them, it was kind of juicy. It was kind of like vitalizing. It was kind of like, oh, this is really interesting. And I kind of felt kind of this joy, and you know. So. And I guess also I'm thinking about calmness because, you know, having this newborn at home. And spend a lot of calm time at home. There's times when he's pretty calm and contented. It's a wonderful thing to sit there with a calm, contented baby. But as he gets older, he's getting a wider range of emotions. The whole range. But certainly his contentment is one of them. And so my wife and I sit with him a lot, and I feel very calm. It's very calm-producing to be with a baby. And but then it's when the other day, my wife was going to go somewhere and was going to take him along in the car. So I put him in the car seat in the house, and he was really fine. I was kind of holding my breath. And then I put his hat on, and he blew up in a rage. I was wondering if the neighbor was going to call the police for child abuse. I lifted the car seat, I was going to put it in the car, and he was just hollering. He was hollering, you know. And it was like painful to listen to for me. I said, okay. And I could feel inside of me the feeling of, oh, something has to happen. I have to do something. You know, and my agitation level and my preoccupation rose because, you know, and not really knowing what to do, whether I could do anything, because he had to go in the car and he had to leave. And the primary person who could do anything at a certain point is my wife. She anatomically has something I don't have. So I just kind of put him there, and my wife got in the car and drove off, and she reported later that by the time she got out of the driveway, he was sound asleep. You know, and the way he can go from complete outrage to find just... He's detached. But it struck me very much the way in which I got caught up in that. How my calmness, how my ability not to get caught by things failed me in a sense. I got caught by his crying that something had to be fixed and I had to do it. And, oh my God. So I'm thinking about calmness these days. So your comments, your questions? Did I calm you all out? So, you know, one of the things that I try to stress is that kind of foundational element of mindfulness practice is mindfulness of the body, is using the body, becoming more embodied. The gateway to a deeper life is through the body. For me, it's very much the case. And that's one of the reasons, is that as an antidote, in a sense, from excessive preoccupation with our thoughts and our thinking. But also because our body is a kind of a body is a more sensitive and more truthful antenna to the world than our thoughts are often. Yes?
You talked about how when you noticed you were anxious, you let go a little bit. I've noticed sometimes when I've noticed something like anger, as opposed to letting go, I'm like, well, good, I deserve to be. You know, build up more. I kind of woke up a really good anger because, you know, once I've noticed, it's like, oh, good, this is good, you know.
Well, why is it good?
I guess at the time I'm telling myself it's, you know, necessary or it's justified.
Yeah, well, it's like a lit match and gasoline. Anger and being justified in your anger. It's just explosive. So, and you think it serves you well? To get more angry and let it build?
Not usually afterwards, no. At the time it seems like it's a good thing. But, and sometimes, you know, there have been times when you know, let your anger go and the outcome is good. You know, maybe draw a line or something with somebody that needs to have a line drawn. And so there are probably times when I think it may be good.
I think so, but one of the things that's interesting is we can sometimes have a beneficial effect from anger, like drawing a line, for example, and we think, oh, then it's justified, the anger is justified, even though it creates a little bit of bad feeling or people feel in whatever. However, many people never learned other skills of drawing lines, and there are other ways of making boundaries or saying no besides getting angry that can be quite effective. So if the only benefit that you feel from anger is it really draws lines, and it's the only way you know how to do that, then I think it's useful to kind of there's many ways of exploring other ways of conflict resolution, other ways of responding to conflict. Yes?
I have found that feeling anger, feeling very alive. And I ask myself, are you ready to let go of the anger? And sometimes the answer is no, not yet. I want to sit and enjoy this for a while. And then, I mean, I'm not talking about where I'm
right.
Spitting out my anger at somebody, but I'm just conscious of it, and I'll let it be there until, okay, now I'm ready to let it go.
Well, that sounds great. There can be a pleasurable part of anger. Certainly the vitality of it and the energy of it can be pleasant, and it can be a trap, because some people become addicted to that, and will spend a lot of time being angry, because that's how they get off. That's how they get to feel alive. And for people, that's what tends to be people who have no sense of natural aliveness, of just being alive, just sitting here doing nothing, you know, can be totally enlivened phenomena. But they feel like they need to do something to get alive. People who go to horror movies perhaps are like that. You know, they get their aliveness from doing a certain thing. And my hope is that people who depend on something like anger for their sense of aliveness, my hope is they can find that aliveness in a more natural way.
Can anger be a skillful mean?
Well, this is a big debate. The Dalai Lama once said, was asked basically that question. And the Dalai Lama, as the story goes, the Dalai Lama closed his eyes, and the people in the audience said it was like he was scanning the universe for an answer to that question. And after a long time, he opened his eyes and he said, no. However, there are other Buddhists and also Buddhist texts and sutras that talk about how it can be sometimes a skillful thing. And sometimes it might be appropriate. What?
Then you're more in charge of it.
It's only skillful if you're in charge of it. If the anger is in charge of you, then it's no longer skillful. And that's part of the danger with anger, is the anger takes over sometimes. And rather than us being conscious of what we're doing. So for example, being angry with a child sometimes, some parents, you know, feel a lot of love, and they express their anger, but there's really no animosity. I think the important thing about anger is to distinguish, and I think maybe helps the discussion about anger, is if we distinguish between anger and hostility. And hostility is never skillful. Hostility is never has a useful place. And if we say that anger is necessarily hostile, maybe anger does have a place. But this is a big subject, and I know that Brigitte gave a wonderful talk on anger some years ago. It's probably in the tape library, or it can be put there. No, it's not there. She gave a wonderful talk on anger. And mostly I agreed with it. Mostly. See, Brigitte and I have had this 7-year conversation. You know, we're coming closer together over the years, but we have a little bit different opinion about anger. And so you see, there's different opinions, and it's not like one is not. I don't feel like I'm necessarily right. The fact that I have a different opinion from Brigitte, you know, isn't that great? Not to necessarily feel you're right, but have a different opinion. But anyway, so I tend to be more in the camp that anger doesn't have any role. That anger, there's other ways, more useful ways, to respond to situations besides anger. But Brigitte, if I may speak for you, it tends to be a little bit more in the camp that anger is can be very useful and should be validated and honored, and more than the degree in which I, and more than she thinks I honor it. So it's good to disagree with me. Yes.
I kind of agree with Brigitte. These things are, you know, put in us for a purpose, and they can all serve a purpose, as you say. It can be used skillfully, and I think in organizing groups of people, anger is a very important tool.
But then the question is, what is the longer term consequences of anger? Does it strengthen the inappropriate use of anger? Does it condition people to tend to respond more angrily or violently? So there are other questions, and then the question I keep repeating. It might be useful, for example, organizing people, but there might be another way, which is as useful. And if we've never learned those ways, then I think we can't really have a real full conversation about the topic, because we don't have the comparison. But I do agree it serves a very important purpose. I'm not going to say any philosophy, any religious teachings to my son. He's not going to listen to me. His anger, he gets furious. The indignation that he expresses, the fury and anger, he gets his way. I bet that it's his expression of anger, I bet, is probably a genetic instinctual thing that has served the human race very, very well. If babies weren't born so incredibly adorable, so you fall in love with them, and if they didn't have such an incredibly powerful way of being angry and outraged when they're hungry, maybe the human race would never have gotten as far as it got. So it has its place. It is skillful if you're a baby.
Doing,
yes, that's true.
Like hat on,
I agree.
Guilty.
That's very, very important point. And what the researchers have found is that parents spend a lot of time putting concepts on what they see in their baby, and it becomes reinforcing. And after a while, the baby learns that. And you might think that's bad. However, I don't think there's any other way. We've been doing it for tens of thousands of years. Yes?
Well, because anger definitely has triggers something.
That's for sure.
Yeah. I know this is universal and it's very human. But for me, I have found that.
See, I was trying to talk about calmness today.
Well, maybe that's what it's happening. It actually has a calming effect for me. For me, I find myself calming down when I name my anger, when I acknowledge my anger. And what you talked about before, the danger is combining anger with the judgment that we're right, what is righteous. And that's why I have trouble with the skillful means. When it's sort of like, if I'm using anger as a skillful means to do something, there's some part of me probably that's attaching my anger to a righteousness. That I'm angry because I'm right, and I'm right. And for me, it's more helpful if I'm angry, it can be a useful and skillful thing for me to acknowledge and know that I'm angry, and it helps me know what's happening inside me.
Yes.
Maybe something that I like or don't like, not necessarily something that's good or bad. Something that is fitting or not fitting for me, or dangerous for me, or stepping on or boundaries. But then it's important then maybe that if I express my anger, it also be expressed in that same way and not as a righteousness to make someone else bad or wrong. But it's an intimacy tool to let somebody know who I am.
Where you're at, yes. I think that's very well stated, and part of my feeling is that anger should always be honored when it appears. But how you honor it is a question. But always honor its presence should be honored. The opposite of being honored is being disgraced or being pushed away or discounted or repressed or suppressed. But to honor is also different than acting on it and giving expression. But to honor it and respect it, I think, is a very important part of mindfulness practice when anger is there, to respect our anger. And to see anger, kind of as what Peggy said, to see anger as a very strong indication that something, somewhere in the universe, is off. And it's very important to know that. And to honor, again, to respect that something is off. You don't know yet maybe where it's off. Or where you think it's off, maybe not really the place where it's off. You might think that what's off is out there. And where it's off, it might be in here. Or you might think it's in here, but it's actually out there. Something is off. And so the power, the usefulness of anger, one of its usefulnesses, and there might be others, is it's a very powerful signal. You need to stop and pay attention and respect that something is going on here where someone somewhere is suffering. And Buddhism is, a lot of what Buddhism as a religion is about is being willing to stop and recognize and look at suffering when we see it fully for itself. And where is the suffering when you're angry? Is the suffering only within you, or is suffering somewhere else? If someone's angry with you, it's the same thing. It's an indication that there's suffering in the universe. Pay attention and notice where the suffering is rather than noticing where the blame is.
obvious that the suffering is always co-arising with the anger?
I think that... he said, am I missing something? Isn't it the case that suffering is always co-arising with anger? Or anger is always co-arising with suffering? Suffering always arises with anger because anger itself is a state of suffering. I can't conceive of it in any other way. However, suffering can arise independent of anger. And sometimes suffering arises first, and then later the anger comes. But with the arising of anger, there's suffering. So one of the things that Buddhism talks about, and I don't talk about very much, is the use of antidotes as a way of bringing our life into balance. And loving kindness is used sometimes as an antidote to anger when you feel like you need to get balance. But the cultivation of calmness, of tranquility, is also a kind of antidote to anger. And one of the very important functions of calmness and tranquility, and why it's kind of championed as importance, is it helps us to see clearer. And learning to see clearly is one of the most important things we're trying to do in mindfulness practice. So may you all become calm, and more importantly, may you all see clearly in your anger and outside your anger. Thank you.